The Linux Night Tech Show.
The Linux Night Tech Show.
The Linux Night Tech Show is on.
Is on.
Your link to the new Linux and the latest technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter. Free software, free speech, open technology, and open mic.
I love it.
Now, live from the Linux Link Tech Show studios, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away.
Hey, isn't it nice that we've gotten to the point that we've forgotten what episode it actually is, or is it just sad that we've all forgotten what episode it actually is?
It's a combination.
I think it's
of both.
226. Yeah, it's 226.
Yes, and this is the first episode of 2008. Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year's.
Well, to kick off the new year, we've got a really awesome guest. We got Aaron Saigal from the KDE Project. Aaron, welcome to the show once again.
Hello, everyone.
It's been a while since we talked to you last time. September 2005, if I'm not mistaken.
Your memory about that's probably better than mine. Yeah.
I remember the conversation. We were talking about it, and I believe we were talking about what was proposed for KDE 4, and you said you would come back once, you know, things were getting near, and things are pretty near. What are we, 8 days out from the official release?
We tag tomorrow.
Oh, tomorrow.
Yeah, awesome. I get to start making changes within the next 24 hours. Packages will start emerging within about 8 days, and we've got the release event in Mountain View on the 17th, and we're right at the wall here.
Awesome. Well, what are some of the really cool things that we could look forward to in the new release?
The way I've been kind of presenting it to people is breaking it down to three, you know, major areas of interest that people really notice right off the top. One is the look and feel issues. The second one is portability and interoperability issues. And the third one is just all the new functionality that is there. A lot of the functionality that is new in 4 is coming with these new frameworks that we spent, you know, a lot of time, much of the last 2 years, working on. What's interesting about the 4.0 release that's coming up is that it's really the first initial release of all of these technologies together. So they're not, you know, people are used to 3.5, right, which has been out there for, you know, 3 years or more now. And even KDE 3 itself was based on KDE 2. So people are used to, like, this very stable, robust, you know, everything kind of screwed down and locked into place KDE, whereas 4.0 is a whole slew of very new technologies. We're at the beginning of a new, you know, progression. So the first thing people are going to notice is that one of the first things anyways that people will notice is that this does feel very much like, you know, a .0 release, in the old fashioned, you know, open source way of releasing, you know, the 0.1 of my new project kind of thing. It's not quite that, you know, immature, because we are building on a lot of really great technology from KDE 3. But it is, there's just an immense amount of new stuff. So I mentioned the look and feel. I think people are going to notice right off the top two things primarily there. One is the Oxygen stuff, the new Oxygen style, which, I mean, changes I've been going in right up until I saw some changes going today, actually. The Oxygen guy's been working on that right up to the wire, as well as the new icon style. They're working on I'm actually watching them work on the sound theme right now on IRC. So there's still some of the Oxygen stuff coming in, but that's a brand new and modern look for the desktop. And then, of course, there's Plasma, which is the new desktop and panels and whatnot. But I think the real interesting story with 4.0 is the interoperability and the functionality parts. I'm sure everyone's heard a million times about, you know, the Solid and Phonon and all the other frameworks that we're bringing out. But essentially, we spent a lot of time looking at what really wasn't working very well on the Free Software desktop and saying, well, why isn't it working very well? Multimedia being a good example of that. And it wasn't for lack of, you know, decent multimedia frameworks. I mean, we have more media frameworks and tools than you can shake a stick at, whether you're looking at, you know, something like Jack or something like Pulse Audio or something like GStreamer or Zine or Ampl. I mean, we just have all these options. The question is, you know, that we kind of pose to ourselves is, why aren't we seeing applications take advantage of this? So our answer was to look at all these different areas, whether it was hardware awareness or instant messaging and presence, or multimedia, or search and metadata, spell and thesaurus checking and or grammar checking and whatnot. And we built frameworks for each of these things. And each one of these new frameworks is actually probably used by only one or two applications in 4.0. 4.1, 4.2, etc. is really going to be a lot about taking these frameworks and placing them in every application possible. So, for instance, Dolphin, the new file manager, which is a complement to Conqueror. It's not a replacement. It complements what Conqueror is. And for those of you who've never used KDE, which I'm sure nobody who's listening hasn't, Conqueror is our all-in-wonder web browser / file manager / organize your world and make tea and put the kids to sleep application. Dolphin is a specific file manager application. That's all it does. It's tuned. The user interface is tuned specifically for file management because everyone wants that all-in-one application. So we're delivering Dolphin. And one of the things that Dolphin does is it ties into the new metadata system. We've been working with the authors of Strigi, which is yet another indexer. There's really three primary indexers right now in the free software world. There's Beagle, Trackers is an up-and-coming, and then there's Strigi. And we picked Strigi because, A, the team that was working on it, well, originally the one guy who was working on it at the very, very beginning, was very keen and open to working with us, which is important, you know, if you're trying to really build something into your platform. He also had a real eye towards interoperability, which has been a big thing for us. So the Strigi team has helped pioneer the ZSAM, XESAM, standard on freedesktop.org that allows us to actually swap in and out say Beagle for Strigi or vice versa, as long as they're, you know, able to speak the ZSIM protocol. So Dolphin is one of the few applications in KDE 4.0 that actually ties into Strigi and this other piece called Nepomuk, all these horrible, horrible names that users will never see. We just have to deal with them as developers. But what Nepomuk and Strigi do is they provide the beginnings of the social semantic desktop, which is a way of tying in metadata about your files and your information, such as where it came from, when you received it, what other files it relates to, the identities of the people involved, both the creators as well as the senders as well as the people you send it to, etc. And it ties us into a web of information that we can then search really quickly. We also use it for very basic things like tagging and saying, oh, hey, I love this MP3. Let's tag it with 5 stars instead of, you know, this other MP3 which really sucked or AUG that really sucked, and I'm just going to put a 1 star on that. So Dolphin provides a way to tag files, rate them, add notes to them, and see the metadata associated with it. And what's neat is that all of that data is stored on disk via, you know, Strigi and ZSIM, and any other application can actually access it. Not just KDE applications, but any application that speaks to the search and indexing system, which is completely independent from KDE itself. Which opens up this opportunity, right, where at some point, you know, as we bring this more to the front in all of our applications, where the metadata that you set in one application will actually be able to be used by other applications. What this means, of course, is the obvious examples of, you know, email attachments, you know, finally being able to say, oh, yeah, by the way, you got this from, you know, so-and-so on an email, you know, dated such and such a date. To more interesting things such as being able to relate media files you have with content creators, content publishers, where you got it from, you know, the sources, the stores, and whatnot. So it really allows us to start breaking down the walls between the applications. So a lot of these new frameworks, we can only, the end user will be able to see the starts of them emerging above the surface, kind of like icebergs, right? Just the tip is above the surface right now. In one or two specific applications, be able to see what's coming. More importantly than that even is application developers who are looking to take advantage of these things will be able to use them and use these applications as examples of how to take advantage of them in their apps. So I think those are some of the things that people are going to start noticing as they start using these applications. They're going to go, whoa, I didn't know, we could do that. Oh, the tagging here actually shows up in Amarok too because they actually share the metadata system. So those are the kinds of things I think people will start to see.
So is this a way for, like, developers to, like, get their applications up and running a little quicker, make the look and feel a little more, unified whenever you have a Qt-KDE-based application?
Definitely. This is the 4.0 release is much more for the three crowds in particular. One, system integrators, people and companies that are looking to take KDE and build products around them and out of them, whether that's people that are looking to do media center stuff, such as the Linux MCE project, or whether it's a Linux distro, or whether it's a company that does third-party support in actual end-user installations. They want to get ahead of the game and know what they're going to be dealing with. That's one group. The other group is our bleeding-edge user base that helps us test things and kick the tires hard. And really, flush out, strengths and weaknesses of the code base. A lot of those people do rely on binary packaging, and they do rely on releases, so we had to make a release to get out to them. And the third group, and really a key group, is the developer audience. So they can, start, porting their applications, writing new applications using these technologies. And what's really cool is that's not just, we're kind of also eroding the artificial, dikes, if you will, between KDE as a desktop environment and application development in general. So Phonon, for instance, as well as Solid and some of these other frameworks don't actually have any other dependencies other than, say, Qt. And StreeG, which we're using, has no Qt dependency at all. It's a C++ application, pure and simple. What this means is that if you're running a Qt4 application, you can use Phonon. In fact, Trolltech is going to be shipping Phonon, or already is shipping Phonon, with Qt 4.4. So that's kind of an interesting thing. It's no longer I like to use the multimedia layer, therefore I have to link in, all the KDE libraries, which is how it was in KDE3. And we spent a lot of time and effort to disentangle all these libraries and really separate them out so that for the application developer, it's a lot more of a straightforward sort of proposition. You can cherry pick. I want, the hardware awareness. I want the messaging and presence. I want the whatever. And you can pick out just those pieces. And of course, we're also bringing these libraries to two very important new platforms, which is Mac OS X and Microsoft Windows, native on both those platforms.
So let me ask you. I have two questions. Mm-hmm. Applications that were written with 3.5, KDE 3.5, are they compatible with 4? And what are some of the core applications that are releasing when you guys release KDE 4?
Sure. So, yeah, I use KDE 4 or KDE 3 applications all the time in my KDE 4 session. A couple of examples of that, I used K3B the other day because I had to burn a CD and there's no KDE 4 port of that yet. That's coming. I was using up until very recently the KDE3 version of KMix because the KDE4 one had some UI problems which got fixed just a couple of weeks ago. About a month ago, actually, I messed up my environment variables that set up all my development environment, and I started Conqueror, and I started using it, and something didn't look right about it. It was just kind of, it looked odd and out of place, and I was trying to think, well, what's wrong with this picture here? And then I realized I was running the one from KDE3. So they actually work rather seamlessly and rather nicely. That's not a problem. And the same thing with GDK apps. We do have right now an outstanding problem if you're using Composite and you're using a GDK 2 application with the system tray icon. GDK 2 does not handle that very well because they don't natively deal with the ARGB visuals in a non-ARGB application very gracefully. So we've got that one little problem to iron out there, but it's pretty minor in the scope of things. In general, everything works really well. If it didn't, I probably wouldn't be able to use my computers because I'm running KDE4, obviously, day-to-day now. So. Oh, and the other question is what core applications, yes?
Yes.
Are shipping with 4? So essentially, everything that comes in a base KDE installation, except for the KDE PIM stuff is still pretty raw. They've been concentrating on what time they do have on the underlying layer of things. So Contact, it does run. It does essentially basically work, but there's a lot of problems with it right now. Underneath Contact, and that's our groupware suite, obviously, mail, calendaring, etc. Underneath that, what they've been, you know, spending the last, you know, year and a half or so working on is a technology called Akinati, which is a very interesting Qt-based data store that handles all of the actual transaction of information in and out of your computer with the rest of the world when it comes to mail and calendaring and whatnot. The whole idea behind that is to make it so that writing new user interfaces on top of groupware information is trivial, as well as to make applications like Contact scale much better. One of the problems you have with Contact and KDE3 is it was very capable and competent, but if you put really huge amounts of data into it, as we're starting to see in some of our enterprise deployments around the world, it would start to bog down and it wouldn't perform well enough. And then we also had some issues with certain types of IMAP connections and whatnot that were just very difficult to also tractable to solve with the way Contact was written. So they revisited that whole scheme of things. And it's turned out to work extremely well. I talked about writing new user interfaces on top of it. There's a Plasmoid, which is the Plasma widget for the desktop that they wrote. It's about 100 lines of code, and then there's an engine that provides the data, basically sits in between this desktop widget and your mail and calendaring store, and it's another couple hundred lines of code. And you have this running commentary of what's going on in your email on your desktop. So with very, very little code, and that was in C++, it would have been even small if they'd use a scripting language to do that. So with very little amounts of code, you can have full access to, you know, all of your POP and IMAP and calendaring and whatnot. So I think it was time well spent. Unfortunately, it's come at the expense of not having Contact ready for 4.0. That's going to be something they're working on for 4.1. Another application that's kind of on the edge and the borders is Copete right now for instant messaging. So other than those two big applications, we are shipping essentially the usual KDE suite of applications, whether that's Conqueror or Dolphin. System settings has replaced K-Control, and it's actually been prettied up and spiffied quite a bit in the last couple of weeks to iron out some of the more glaring issues we had in the betas and release candidates. Console, obviously. KOffice is going to be releasing an alpha. They're obviously not part of the KDE main releases, but they're actually will be doing another alpha along with 4.0. But yeah, it's the general suite of applications.
Cool. We got a question from the RC. Go ahead, Dan.
That's a pretty powerful list of stuff that's not ready yet for KDE4.
Yep.
So for KDE4, do you see this as being, I don't want to say a beta release and go down the whole thing you guys have with the Linux Action Show about what's beta, what's not. But
right.
What do you see adopting KDE4 at this point? What's the target audience?
And again, I like to make the differentiation, of course, between KDE4 and KDE4.0. Right? So we're releasing 4.0, which is the .0 release of the KDE4 series. And that's a really important distinction to make. What's interesting is that as free software has become more and more successful, people start to compare, the releases of free software. And this is more than just KDE. This is a general community and kind of a holistic issue in the free software world right now. People start to compare, and not rightly so, free software development cycles with proprietary development cycles. And and it's understandable why one would carry over, you know, similar expectations, simply because, you know, well, software is software, right? Well, not really, because we develop software, obviously, in the free software world completely differently than one does in the proprietary world. Oh, we both write, you know, we do designs, we work in teams, we write code, we debug, etc., we profile. So in that sense, we're the same. But the actual mechanism and methodology is different. And I think I actually referenced the same Linus Torvalds interview in the Linux Action Show, where he talked about this different model of development is very different, but it gives Linux, the kernel, an unassailable advantage over proprietary software efforts that are in the same, you know, in the kernel space. So we're kind of you're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. You have, you know, you can continue doing what has worked for you as a free software project, which is, you know, release early, release often, get releases out there, keep things going and grinding, or you can hold on to it and try and wait until you've got something, you know, that's perfect. And then do a release, you go, look, this is exactly like, you know, this other proprietary software product. And that simply isn't how the free software world used to work, and it's not how free software is developed or open source software is developed at all. So we've got kind of this mismatch between expectation and reality, right? And the expectation comes from the community of people, where of users, you know, and the kind of people that listen to these shows, where they go, well, you know, I expect, you know, this 4.0 to be exactly like, you know pick your poison, whichever one you want. You know, it's exactly like Windows XP or like, you know, the first release of Mac OS X or whatnot. And that's not how free software is developed. Simple. There's no other way of putting it. We could sit on this release for another year or two and churn away on it and release something in a year or two, but that eliminates huge amounts of the actual benefit of working in an open source, you know, method, which is you do these, you know, constant releases. Unfortunately, when you're doing constant releases, you're going to have releases that are more raw than you would have in a commercially shipping product that you know, proprietary product that, you know, the here's our, we're going to put it in a box and put it on a store shelf until you reach a certain point. And once you reach that certain point, you cross a threshold, and then your releases start becoming, you know, solid and more mature. So with 4.0, we're introducing so many new technologies and so many, you know, some of these applications are, you know, very new. I mean, Dolphin was, I mean, compare Dolphin and KD4 to what the, you know, version in KD3 was, and it was a young app then, and it's night and day difference. A lot of these applications are very, very new. You know, things obviously like Plasma are new. Console has had a huge rewrite happen to it, mostly for the better. You know, we can sit on that and not deliver anything to anybody, but I don't think that's good for anyone. We're not going to be able to take advantage of the, you know, the many eyes principle. We're not going to be able to take advantage of the rapid release cycle that really gets, you know, the pace of development at its maximum. So who's going to actually, that's kind of a long way of explaining, you know, the whole, what is 4.0 and why are we releasing 4.0? Essentially because we're a free software project. One has to, you know, release at some point. So who's going to be using 4.0? Well, I mentioned earlier the three audiences. And I think those are the people that are going to be, you know, looking at 4.0. 4.1, which is probably going to be a fairly quick release, actually, is going to start to be used by a lot more of the rank and file user base. And somewhere between 4.1 and 4.2, we'll see, you know, a mainstream, desktop emerge where you'll put, you know, 4.2 next to, you know, the kind of solidity and stability that we had in 3.5, and you go, okay, there's a level of maturity that's been achieved here. And I think that we'll see it really quickly. I mean, 4.2 versus 3.5.7, right? It's a much shorter time frame, but I think building from where we are now to then is realistic. Does that answer your question, or did I completely confuse you?
So you guys aren't going to sit around for 5 years doing development, spending $300 million?
No, and then scrap it and try it again. Yeah, no. No. And, I mean, I think that's one of the things that I'm really proud of with this team is we sat down and we put together an extremely long horizon project, right? Something that would normally take, you know, 5 years and, you know, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars to do. And we sat down and went, well, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to try and do it in a year and a half, maybe. Maybe a year. It ended up taking us two. But we said, these are the features we want. We want, like, a search and indexing system that ties in your metadata. We want to rework how we do media. We want, you know, much better ways of handling, you know, hardware media. We want to rework the way that we're approaching the desktop and the panels and whatnot. We want, you know, a composited window manager. We want, you know, applications that, you know, are much easier for the group of people for which Conqueror is too powerful. We want to revisit K-Control because the tree view for not everyone, but for the majority of our user base is really difficult to use, et cetera. And we sat down with all of these. I mean, this list was ridiculous. It was insane. And we sat down and, you know, 2 years later, we've got, you know, a first release that is delivering these sets of functionality. Some of them are more embryonic than others. Some of them are very mature, like Phonon, but are only seeing in a few applications. But, I mean, we've delivered. And I think that's a huge testament to the vision of everyone in the project, and as well as the stick-to-itiveness. I mean, to actually stick through something for 2 years, especially when there is, you know, a healthy amount of naysaying going on, and actually deliver something is, I think, everyone who's involved, you know, the hundreds of people that have put, you know, their blood, sweat, and tears into this, I think it's a huge accomplishment on their part.
So there was a little brouhaha about a week ago, where there was an article that was passed around that said that about KDE not being supported in the LTS version of Ubuntu.
Right.
So based upon what you said, it makes sense as to why Ubuntu 4.0 or KDE 4.0 would not show up in the LTS release of Hardy Heron. But KDE 3.5 is still going to be viable for a good chunk of years yet, isn't it?
Absolutely.
What are your feelings about that possibility of not being supported in long-term support from Canonical?
Well, I'll address the 3.5 issue first because that is really important. We have installations of KDE 3.5, large ones, important ones, depending on how you want to measure them, right? I mean, we've got the EEE PC, which is set to sell 5 million units by summer. And that's all, you know, the KDE software in there is all 3.5 based. Or even actually a little bit older than that. I think it's 3.4 based. So we've got, you know, that's one, you know, good chunk of users right there. We've got others like, you know, the French Parliament that, you know, have, you know, just this past year have, you know, started that move, and, you know, they'll be using KDE 3.5 as well. These kinds of installations move really slowly. They don't change year to year. These kinds of installations, you know, 3 years is an aggressive schedule for these kinds of people. More realistic for a lot of those, you know, especially the larger deployments, you know, is 5 to 7 years. And they'll, you know, when they decommission hardware, and they'll try and, you know, eke as much out of it as they can, and then they'll, you know, run into their own inertia. And so, I mean, we've got 3.5. It'll last for a good long while. And, you know, our revision control system is open. We haven't closed 3.5. I mean, that would be silly, because, I mean, if a security flaw comes up, we need to fix it. People are absolutely welcome to continue, you know, bug fixing, working on applications, etc. As a core project, we have focused our efforts on KDE4, obviously because that's the future, that's, you know, the long term, you know, if we look out at the horizon, that's where things are going to be, and we have limited manpower within the core project. But we have a lot of people that, you know, work on KDE stuff that, you know, isn't within just the core project. So 3.5 will inevitably have a many-year lifespan simply because of where it's being installed right now, the installations that exist within, as well as, you know, the people that are going to continue to build on it. And there's nothing, we have nothing against people whatsoever, you know, working with us to actually even improve 3.5 further. That'd be fine. So that, I think, is a given. So the question is, what is the whole long-term support and et cetera? I think every organization makes choices. And those choices, I think, say a lot more about the organization that makes the choice than anything else. And I think there was kind of a confluence of issues that kind of came to play in that decision. I wasn't involved in it in any way, shape, or form, by the way. So, I mean, I'm speaking with just a bit more insight maybe than the rest of you, but I'll share my two cents anyways. One, there was a decision, you know, to, you know, try and move Kubuntu aggressively towards KDE4. And in one sense, you know, we've got the Linux distros all kind of jockeying for who's got the newest and the latest and the greatest and who's, you know, able to move the fastest and whatnot. And that's cool because it, you know, it encourages a certain amount of competition between them, and, you know, make sure that nobody sits still for too long and things stagnate. It's cool in that sense. unfortunately, sometimes I think they get a little, they kind of lose sight of the goal of their user base, which is, you know, software that works for whomever they are. And so there's, you know, everyone's been going, who's going to have KDE 4 first? In fact, there's been blogs from people at distributions, and not just Kubuntu, right? I mean, we're talking about, you know, Novell 2s, et cetera, saying, who's going to have 4.0 first? Well, you know, we bet we will, or, you know they will, or whatever. And so there's been this mad dash, and I think that the Kubuntu people may have overcommitted committed too strongly, too overtly within, you know, their camp. I think that might have scared them off. Go, okay, maybe we can't LTS this release. And the other, you know, bald fact of the matter is that I don't think that Canonical really offers the mind space, the mind share, and quite frankly, the respect that KDE has earned. And so they don't, you know, they're a little bit more laissez-faire when it comes to decisions around the KDE software, which is unfortunate, I think, because if you look at where, you know, deployments are happening of Ubuntu-based software on the desktop, and a lot of them are using KDE. You know, I mentioned the French Parliament earlier. That's an Ubuntu installation, but it's actually a Kubuntu installation. So I don't particularly agree with or understand, you know, wholly. I understand from their perspective. I've talked about it with Mark and his crew, you know, at great length about how they arrived at their decisions and what their current positions are and mindset is. And I understand their, you know, their thinking and their context, and, you know, it makes a fair amount of sense, you know, within the way that they framed it. I don't particularly agree with it, and I think that it results in brouhahas like this that are completely unnecessary, where they make a decision, well, we're not going to LTS, you know, this release, and which is going to be a confusing message for their, you know, their user base in the market, because it's no longer an across-the-board thing. I think this will turn out in the long run to be, you know, I don't think a fatal blow at any mean to them, but I think it'll pan out to be one of those things they look back on and go, we should have done that differently.
So I got a couple questions.
Wait, hold on a second, Pat. I want to ask a related question to this, and then you can bash him with the questions from the IRC. So you had mentioned that the Triple EPC and mm-hmm. A few other projects that having and the French government going over to using KDE Desktop, and how they're going to be on KDE 3.5 for a good amount of time. Who then becomes responsible for the upkeep and the maintenance of KDE then, from their perspective? Is it ASUS with the Triple EPC or Zandros with the operating system that they supply? I mean, who takes over the mantle of providing the upkeep for
support
that?
Support for that.
Your support. And does right. Are they contributing back to the KDE project as a whole?
Those are really good questions. This is something that we've worked, you know, increasingly hard on, you know, in the last few years in the project, is, you know, building meaningful relationships with all sorts of groups, whether they are nonprofits or free software projects or, you know, corporations. So in this particular example with ASUS, they've been working with Zandros. Zandros is one of those shops that is pretty hermetically sealed, as far, you know, they do interact with the KDE project, but they're pretty self-sufficient. They don't rely on us too much, other than to provide, you know, the raw resources that we provide in the form of source code. Although they do, you know, come to our conferences, and we do, you know, talk to them. They're a part of the foundation, the KDE EV, and whatnot. But in addition to them, so I mean, they, you know, Zandros is obviously providing some amount of upkeep and support there. Aside from them, there are others that are contracted as well, I believe directly by ASUS, to work on Triple EPC issues related to KDE specifically, and not just the current, but also the next step. I mean, this isn't a point-in-time product for ASUS, right? This is a first release of their new set of ideas, and I think a really compelling one. But they're already looking at, you know, where do we go from here? What's the next step? What could be better? What software should we be using? How do we migrate, you know, 3 years out? What do we do from that point forward? And they're not going to sit in stasis on 3.5, I don't think, forever. But, you know, for this current product lifecycle, you know, definitely they've got companies both in North America in the form of Zandros, as well as in Europe, that are, you know, in contractual agreements with them, that are supporting the KDE 3.5 software they use. And there was a second question, was there? Or did they contribute back?
Yes.
That's an interesting one.
That sounds like a no.
Yeah, they do, actually, although ASUS is doing it kind of indirectly. And it's such a typical story, right, in the sense that, you know, you see whenever an actor is new to the open source free software world, it's kind of like throwing – did any of you ever do what do they call it when you go to another country to study school, foreign exchange program?
I know what you're talking about.
Another culture?
Yeah.
Yeah, have you ever been dropped to another culture just like blindly and had to live there? That's what it's like for you know, companies or anybody really that comes into the open source and free software world. It's like this whole new language, this whole new set of cultures and customs and, you know, ways of interacting. You know, the grand poobahs and leaders they are used to in one place are not the same here anymore. The citizenry is different. Everything is different. It's a completely new landscape. And it takes quite a while for new entrants to come, you know, actually find a way to interact with the community. And so what I think is really cool with ASUS is that some of the people that are working with in Europe are actually helping them chart these waters and actually helping them find ways to interact better with the community and give back to the community and whatnot. And I can't really say a whole lot about it right now because it's still in work, and if I mention anything, they'd get mad at me for stealing their thunder and announcing things that aren't ready to be announced yet. But, you know, they're working on things to actually, you know, increase their exposure. And I think that's really the way to do it, because when you go to a new country or a new culture, one of the first things you do, right, is you get a guide. You find someone who does know the place, that does know the lay of the land, hopefully knows as many of the locals and the cool places as possible, and you ask them to take you around, introduce you, and teach you as much about this new world as possible. And that's kind of the track that ASUS is going on. Some groups chart that better than others. Some never get it. Some free software groups, and you know, ostensibly, well, groups that put out free software, let's put it that way, or open source software, some of them don't even get it to this day. But some do, and it's a learning process. So some of the companies you work with are extremely, you know, give back. And some that you wouldn't even expect, like Google, for instance, with our release event, they've been absolutely huge in helping us. They're, you know, they give us a place to host it at, which is at their campus. They're providing a bunch of catering. They've been helping us with the organization and the planning with it, with weekly phone calls to their own people. Chris DeBone's going to be there talking. They've been great, and primarily for two reasons. One, they use KDE internally on a lot of machines, and they're generally interested in free software, right? So it's really a cultural thing. In the case of ASUS, they're just cutting their teeth. The good news is I'm seeing them make steps towards actually interacting with the community. And with this being really their first public release of anything that is significant in relation to free software, for them to start, you know, this soon, is pretty impressive given that they're coming from the proprietary world.
Cool.
We got a couple questions from the RSC, Aaron. Viola Ken, who's a developer of QDVD Author, he wants to know, is it worth it to convert to QT4 instead of staying at 3 and invest time and energy into its improvements?
Absolutely. And there's a number of reasons for this, right? Number one, Q4 is going to be seen across more platforms than ever before. One reason is that we're now part of the LSB. So distributions that are aiming for compliance with that, you know, they're going to be shipping Qt 4, so it's going to be, you know, very pervasive, especially in relation to Qt 3. As KDE 4 becomes, you know, the mainstream desktop, it's going to be, you know, even more available, and then with it being GPL'd on Windows, you know, that platform opens up. So one is availability, and I think that over the next, you know, couple of years, we're going to see Qt 4 just really in many ways phase out Qt 3, and Qt 3 will be, you know, kept around essentially for legacy applications that still use it and will disappear with them. From a developer's perspective, it's funny. I went back and had to, it was several months ago now, maybe 4 or 5 months ago, and talking about KDE 3.5, I actually had to go and fix, well, I didn't have to, I did. I went and fixed some bugs. No one was holding a gun to my head, but I went and fixed some bugs in some KDE 3.5 software that needed attention. And after working with Qt 4 and the KDE 4 stuff for, you know, a year and a half plus at that point, and having to go back to Qt 3 and KDE 3, I started asking myself, wow, how do we ever deal with this? this feels really, you know. And back in the day, that was like such great APIs to deal with, and it was like, wow, we have so much functionality, and we've just come so far beyond that. I mean, the major benefits are the API in Qt 4 is just head and shoulders above what was in Qt 3. And Qt 3 was known for its API. It was known for a consistent, quality, well-documented API, and Qt 4 just takes it to a whole new level. They've done little things like take out Booleans and replace them with enumerations in the API so that when you're reading code, it actually looks more like a human speaking as opposed to a machine talking to you. It's not a bunch of true, false, true. It actually is obvious what it's doing. The model view stuff is very powerful. The new painting framework, Arthur, I deal with a lot of the graphic stuff on a daily basis, and all the stuff that as a project we used to hack around because of limitations in Qt 3 as far as painting and whatnot are just solved in Qt 4. The alpha blending support, the advanced support for just they provide a modern graphical rendering toolkit. And Qt 3 was modern at its time, but that was a number of years ago. And Qt 4 just makes I don't hack around things anymore. I'm able to implement what I want directly in the code as opposed to having to work around their issues, which results in software that works the first time more often, is simply more flexible, and it lets me focus on features as opposed to working around the rough edges in Qt. And I think that really says a lot about Trolltech in the sense that they're able to take a product that was good and then pick it apart and find ways to make it great. And that's a big inspiration for us in KDE as well. I mean, you'll find the KDE 4 APIs are, we took a lot of the lessons from what they did in Qt 4. In fact, we actually had their engineers come out and speak to us at the last few KDE World Conferences, the academies, and actually talk to us about designing C++ interfaces and how, what they've learned and how the new techniques that they're working with. That's really taught us a lot. So, I mean, definitely it's worth it. It's a bit of work depending on what aspects of Qt 3 you're using, which frameworks and which APIs. If you're doing painting stuff, you're going to be rewriting a lot of stuff. If you have low-level painting routines, the model view stuff is brand new, so if you want to take advantage of the model view architecture, there's more code to be written there. But a lot of stuff ports over fairly easily, and we've actually got a decent number of porting scripts in the KDE SDK module, Software Development Kit module, in the scripts directory that actually help you automate porting from, basically doing there's a couple of Perl scripts in there that do search and replaces on text, and there's a tool that comes with Qt 4 that actually starts you on a path anyway from porting a Qt 3 code base to Qt 4 1. So you can automate the boring, simple, trivial stuff, and it's just a matter of getting it working. The Amarok people, they within, a month or so of starting to work on their Qt 4 port, KDE 4 port, actually had something that was playing. So, I mean, it's obviously not perfect at the, even now, but the initial port was, doable.
Okay, a couple of real trolling type questions, but they
oh, brilliant. My
these
favorite
guys
kind.
These guys they want to know it though.
Yeah.
What's the biggest
yeah.
philosophy difference between KDE and GNOME, and why mm-hmm. should a GNOME user switch to KDE 4.0?
Ooh. Well, I'm actually going to sidestep the first question a bit. I'm not going to talk about GNOME's philosophy because I'd feel as bad about talking about their philosophy as if a GNOME developer tried to talk about the KDE philosophy. And the bald fact of the matter is that unless you're deeply part of that community, it's far too easy to not grasp, the philosophy within the project. You can obviously look at the surface philosophies, right, where you look at GNOME and they pay a lot of attention to trying to simplify the interface and they have an emphasis on make it do the few fundamental things well and then kind of build up from there, and they've put a lot of focus in the last couple of years on some of the glue that's really been needed between kernel and user space, like the HAL debus stuff. I mean, a lot of people that have been traditionally associated with GNOME have worked on those things, which is really cool. And we've been working, with those things as well in KDE 4. You could reflect on the surface philosophies, but the deep philosophies, I wouldn't feel comfortable talking about that. those are things that take years and
you actually have a good, you actually have a good relationship with the GNOME developers, right?
We hang out and there's more than a few GNOME developers that have embarrassing photographs of, say, me singing karaoke or being out, you know, drinking with them or whatnot. Yeah, we hang out and we talk, and I mean, you'll find people that, you know, you think are traditionally KDE people or GNOME people on each other's planets, you know, with their blogs syndicated there. We go to each other's, you know, main conferences, GWADEC and Academy. There's a lot of cross-pollination there. I count, you know, a good number of really hardcore GNOME developers as, you know, personal friends, actually. Just because, I think a lot of the animosity, you know, was definitely there in the early days, and I think it was earned in the early days. I think there was a lot of uncalled for and ridiculous crap that happened in the 90s that was uncalled for and completely, in my opinion, inexcusable. But we moved on since then, you know, and I think it's a testament to, you know, people that were involved that we found this way to kind of chart through it and go, okay, well, that sucked, but, you know, who benefits from that? Nobody. Okay, where can we go from here? And out of that has resulted a large number of really great relationships, both personal as well as technical. I talked about interoperability a bit earlier about KDE4. We replaced DCOP with DBus, strictly out of interoperability concerns. You know, we wanted to be able to work with, you know, HAL, we wanted to work with, you know, GNOME apps, we wanted to work with, you know, other applications that are using DBus natively, and we've contributed a lot back. We've taken, you know, the ATK SPI stack and provided a DBus-based bridge for it for accessibility purposes. And we've worked on, you know, DBus itself and extended it quite, you know, in important areas. So there's a lot of technical cross-pollination that happens now as well, and that's a direct result of finding ways to create personal relationships, you know, because that's really what technology is, right? It's creative people coming together and creating. And I think that a lot of the progress that's happened in the last few years, regardless of what project you're looking at, has happened because we've kind of put aside a lot of these issues and started working together, and it's sped up everybody's development. So I think it's benefited everybody to do that, and that's exactly why I'm not going to comment on their philosophy. I don't think that's of benefit to anybody. If you have specific questions about KDE's philosophy, I'd be happy to answer them.
I have more questions regarding KDE 4.0. You guys are doing KWin effects. You're going to have some compositing effects, right?
Yep.
What was the drive behind this? You know, we have Compiz, Barrel. You know, mm-hmm. And we've seen some of the other things, Matisse. Why is KWin necessary?
Why is KWin necessary? Okay. So, how many pieces of prototype hardware do you use on a daily basis? Do you drive a prototype car? Do you live in a prototype house? No. I mean, these are kind of rhetorical questions. You don't. We generally, you know, people use production quality, you know, stuff. And KDE is not a research project. You know, we do have a couple of researchy kind of projects, including some that are funded by the European Union that are actually classified as research. But in general, KDE, we don't deliver, you know, we're not a research arm at a university. We deliver production software. So we looked at the, you know, exciting world of, you know, composited window management, which is not just, you know, glitzy glamour effects either. I mean, it has some really important real-world effects. There are things that you can do for accessibility, for instance, as far as screen magnification, that just really aren't easily possible without, you know, compositing. And then, yeah, it also looks really cool, right? And there's no two bones about it. People like stuff that looks good. And they like interfaces that are cool. I think that's the number one reason why the iPod is the dominant player. It's just simply the best interface out there, regardless of all the other warts and whatnot around it. So, you know, we realized that we needed, you know, as far as we were concerned anyways, to provide, you know, composition support in KDE. But we needed something that we could also, you know, look at people that are, you know, running schools, governments, and corporations and go and look at them with a, you know, straight face and go, yes, you can use this. So Compiz, it has trailblazed, you know, a very important area. You know, especially David, who worked a lot on the underlying X stuff, not just the window manager, but the stuff in X to actually make this possible. they've done a tremendous amount of work, and the people that use CompViz and whatnot on a daily basis, they love it, and that's great. But we need a window manager that allowed a non-composited option, because it's not always an option given the hardware mix or the delivery of the system. We also needed a window manager that actually managed Windows properly. And that's actually, once you've got the underlying compositing technologies available in for instance, Xorg, getting the compositing stuff, it's not trivial to do in a window manager, but it's a lot easier to get that in and working than it is to get a perfectly working window manager. Because with window management, you've got, so the lead developer is Lubos Lunak of KWin, and he, I like to playfully say he hates me because I'm always pushing at the borders of what we can do with window management on X with a lot of the stuff that I do in my applications. And I'm always causing grief for him and inventing new problems. Like the new dashboard thing in Plasma is completely unseen elsewhere outside of, window managers. And so it's a completely new set of problems that he's having to deal with. But you've got crazy people like me doing crazy things, and you've got, things that are simply broken. Like a lot of Java VMs, just when they throw up a window, completely mismanage it, and their window management's completely screwed. It's hosed. So you've got all these weird little things. You've got applications like, XMMS and its offspring that try and self-manage their windows, and so the window manager and the application are fighting with each other, and you have to, provide all these ways to, do the right thing. And then you've got, applications that pop up can you enter your password here box in front of, even when they're in the background. And so the window manager has to be able to say, okay, well, this program wasn't actually the focused application. So even though the program is trying to put its, sensitive dialogue in front of everything else, I probably shouldn't, because the user's actually working over here. If I pop this dialogue up, it's going to, interrupt the user flow, and that's called focus stealing prevention. So there's all of this work you have to do in window management. That's actually years and years of work, and there's no way of just sitting down with a nice, specification and implementing the spec. You actually have to test out against, tens of thousands of applications. So KWin is, more than anything else, the amalgamation of years and years and years and years of bug fixes to make window management work really well. And I think KWin is, in that sense, is a remarkably great window manager. So we need both, right? We need compositing window management and effects, but we also need really good quality window management. And we simply decided to go the route that would cost us the least. So if we took something like CompViz or whatnot, we'd have to work on how do we integrate that with other KDE applications where necessary. But we'd also have to improve the window management parts of it. And especially when we started with KDE4, even more so then than now, but it's still a valid point even today, it's just easier and less work to do it this way around. And you look at the people that are working on Metacity, and they've made the exact same decision for, fairly similar reasons.
Trolls has a follow-up question. He wants to know, you mentioned CompViz charting a path in the underlying layers of the stack. What has KDE done in the same regard?
Sure. So at Trolltech, for instance, we've done a fair amount of work on X technology and drivers. We actually employed Zach Russin for, a couple of years or a few years there. And he did a fair amount of work at that time, looking at what's going on in X. Things like EXA, for instance, the acceleration architectures and whatnot, were things that he worked on. So, we've done some work on X. We've got a couple of people in the KDE project that work on lower level X issues as well. Again, I tend to, for whatever reason, run into things that X sucks at, and we fortunately have a couple of people in the project that I can go to and go, okay, am I doing this completely wrong, or am I actually thinking that X is trying to do this on me? And they'll go, yeah, they are, and there's probably a better way of doing that. And they'll either suggest a way for me to change my code, or they'll at times actually provide, and submit patches and fix things in X. So we do work, for instance, in X. And more importantly, I think we work with the people in X. We also contribute to, things like Dbus and the surrounding tools around Dbus. We're very involved with freedesktop.org, which you can kind of look at the lower layer in the stack, area. We the MIME type spec and whatnot we've adopted in KDE 4, and a lot of the specifications on freedesktop.org were inspired in part or in whole by stuff that we've done in KDE. So at the same time, we don't try and run around and play, you know, Viking Raider and invade every other project. We do have a certain, I think, a healthy amount of respect for the fact that a lot of these other projects that work on non-trivial problems of their own, you know, they're probably, you know, they have the, you know, a good team and are probably the most ready and whatnot to work on it. We've got a lot of stuff to do ourselves. What's most important, though, I think, is the interfaces between projects, where if you have people talking to each other, if you have people cross-pollinating ideas, software, technology, if we can freely communicate between the different layers, hey, we have a problem here. And that's really the cool thing about going to, you know, things like the Ottawa Linux Symposium, where you get the kernel guys and user space guys in the same room, with kernel space guys yelling at, you know, the user space guys for how much they suck, and then the user space guys turning around and going, well, how about we try and work out power management so that it doesn't suck either? You know, you get this cross-pollination that happens. Those kinds of events are just absolutely wonderful. And then out of that comes long-term relationships where, you know, I run into a problem and I can bop off an email to one of, you know, several dozen people that I know in these different projects and go, hey, I kind of run into this issue. What's your thoughts on this? You know, how are you folks going to address this and whatnot? And so those kind of relationships, I think, are very important. And as the different projects become more vital in and of themselves, I mean, Xorg, you know, finally really becoming a project that has real legs out of X386, for instance, was a really huge step, because it took a lot of the question about what are we doing with that layer off the plate for people like, you know, GNOME and KDE. So we work with projects both on a personal level but also on a technical level.
KDE runs on Linux, it runs on BSD, it runs on Solaris. What about Windows and Mac?
Right. So with 4, we've got native ports for both Windows and Mac. And this is really cool. Before, you could run it on Mac, KDE applications, but it was, you know, it was basically through X11. With Qt 4, the Mac support's really good, and on Windows, it's GPL now. So we have a free software solution across, you know, all of our platforms, be it a Linux-based, a BSD-based, a Unix operating system, or Mac, or Windows. So we kind of sat back and we, you know, had a lot of discussion about how we were going to approach this and what made sense, both from the project's point of view as well as, you know, as a larger free software issue. And one of the things, you know, we kind of start out with a couple of positions that we need good justifications for doing this. We don't want to get distracted by this. We don't want to pull, you know, people that are working on Linux, for instance, and, you know, send them all off into Windows land. You know, we really wanted to see the emergence of a Windows community and a Mac community if we're going to do this. And that has been happening, which is really cool. So at the release event, actually, in a couple of weeks, we have, you know, people from the Windows team and the Mac team that are going to be there demoing stuff. So that's pretty cool. So what does native mean? Well, it means that you can actually run the binaries, you know, natively. There's no compatibility layer. There's, you know, you're not going to be confronted with the KD4 look and feel. You won't see Oxygen or whatnot. You'll actually see the native Xpure Vista widgets. You'll see the native Mac OS 10 widgets when you're running those platforms. And we've done a fair amount of work. Some still have to be done to allow things such as replacing the file dialog, the KD file dialog, with the file dialog that appears on Windows or Mac, to really make them feel as native as possible. And the result is you get applications that, you know, look, you know, very native, so that, you know, on Mac you get the menu bar in the right place at the top of the screen, and, you know, if there's a system tray icon, it goes into the dock, you know, and doesn't float around in outer space on the desktop and whatnot. Multimedia is another good example. So phone on, we now have backends for QuickTime on Mac and Direct Show on Windows, and of course we support both Xeon and GStreamer on Linux. So this is a kind of a brand new world for us, and there's two things we're hoping to get out of it. One is much, much broader developer reach. As you know, annoying as it is a realization, for every one of us that is hacking on a free software operating system, you know, there are thousands that are running code on, you know, either Windows or Mac. And so we're trying to bring some of the free software stack to them as a way to bring them to the free software stack and start contributing and working with free software code rather than continuing to buy into simply the proprietary tools that they you know have known up until now. The other thing that we're going to do is help spread standards. So Exchange, for instance. I mean, that Microsoft Exchange is just a thorn in, you know, the free software giant side, right? I mean, how do we deal with it? How do we get rid of it? And it's a real conundrum because it's not just a server-side problem. It's both server-side and client-side because Exchange is kept in place as much by Outlook as anything else. So until we have, and you know, Microsoft's not going to step up and go, well, we're going to, you know, make Outlook work really well with, you know, Colab or Open Groupware or what, or eGroupware, right? They're just not going to do that. They make it rather difficult and annoying, actually. So by being able to provide client-side software on Windows and Mac that we in the free software world have a direct influence over, such as Contact and Akinati, we can actually start to play the client-server game that, you know, Microsoft has played very effectively and very well over the years. And we can start to level that playing ground so that instead of, you know, being stuck with Exchange because they're stuck with Outlook, now people can choose between, you know, a number of different groupware servers because they can now choose, you know, pick between Outlook and Contact. And I think this is, again, something that I don't think that a lot of Linux distributors have realized yet. I don't think that's been an internalized realization that with some of the stuff we're doing with KDE4, it has the potential to be, have some very fundamental positive impact on their server side as well. I'm hoping that as, you know, those tie-ins occur over time that, you know, some of the Linux distros start to realize this and put more effort again into the desktop and start to play that client server synergy. But other than Exchange, there's also things like ODF versus, you know, OXML. And if we can't deliver applications that read and write ODF, you know, we can be ISO'd and whatever else certified we want, people aren't going to use it. So we need to be able to deliver applications that give people interoperability with open standards before they'll, you know, seriously, in a mainstream way, use it. So that, those are the, you know, the two big things we look to get. More developers into free software and more open standard usage.
Okay.
We just have small
I got a question.
Yep.
Question regarding memory usage. I've heard different things. Some people say that the memory usage is really awesome with QT4, that, you know, it's like 30-40% less, you know, intensive resource hog. It's, it runs better. It runs quicker. And then I've heard contradictory, you know, reports from other people. Well, what's the lowdown?
Well, yeah, statistics, right? There's lies, damn lies, and statistics. Measuring performance and measuring memory is insanely difficult to do, in part because modern kernels do so much magic and lie so much to user space in order to be able to more efficiently manage resources that it's really hard to measure these things. So when people do get it wrong, I don't really blame them. I mean, I've gotten measurements wrong myself in the past, even things, you know, I've, you know, spoken about, you know, 5 years ago. You know, I did some measurement of console usage, and I actually had to revise my numbers. It wasn't significantly different, but I had to revise my numbers because my, you know, methodology wasn't quite right. It's really difficult to do. So, you know, people will get things, you know, wrong at times. You'll get all these contradictory statements. So the reality is that Qt4 is a lot leaner than Qt3 in most areas. And the reason that we, you know, there's so much push on that was Qt4 is also, Trollflake used to have one branch for embedded devices, one branch for desktop stuff. And as we started to, you know, within Trolltech expand our viewpoint and our reach, these branches stopped making sense a long time ago. So Qt4 really needed to run on embedded devices as well, and small form factor devices and whatnot. So that meant making, you know, the whole toolkit smaller, faster, lighter, better. And you know, it was achieved through a lot of work. It's obviously not magic, and it's not like, you know, oh, it uses 0 kilobytes of memory, but it is better than what you get with Qt3. We've also done things in KDE4, such as the background processes that run that you never see, the little bits of programming glue that run, such as KDE init, KDD and whatnot that, you know, you never really see, but they're necessary. Those used to link into the graphical toolkit and actually have access to the graphical layer. And they never used it, and all it did, you know, was to serve to bloat their memory footprint, as well as it would make them take longer to start up. So when you first start up your desktop, you know, you'd have to wait for all these programs to start, and they'd all be, you know, initializing connections to, you know, the X server, and they'd be loading up all of this GUI-related stuff that they would never use. Well, with KD4, anything that doesn't use graphical, it doesn't have an interface, doesn't link to anything related to the GUI, so no X, no Qt GUI, no nothing. Those kind of decisions and changes in how we do things has contributed to things such as faster startup on my desktop. On my desktop here, if my disk caches are not stone cold dead, I'm getting logins to a useful desktop within literally like 3 seconds, and that's on my an AMD 20-something 22. It's not a new machine by any sleight of the imagination. I'm not saying everyone's going to get a 3-second login. But that's what, I've been generally getting, 3 to 5 seconds, which is, on the same machine, noticeably faster than what I'm getting with KD3. Individual applications start up faster. A lot of applications take less memory to do the same things. But it's not a win rate across the board either. We do, there's more double buffering that happens, the compositing. That compositing works by actually painting off screen, right? Indirect rendering. So the program paints to what it thinks is, I'm painting to the screen, but it's not. It's painting to an off-screen buffer. And that isn't magic either. That's memory that gets used, right? So then the Win Manager then takes these off-screen bitmaps and composites them, which is where the name comes from, into one picture that actually appears on screen. And that's how it can do all the effects and whatnot behind the application's back. That takes more memory because we need places to store those pixmap textures. So it's kind of yes and no and maybe and whatnot, mostly because the comparable features almost across the board are lighter in KD4, both faster and take less memory. But there are some new things that we're doing that, if you turn compositing on, you're going to notice that there's more memory usage. And that's simply to take advantage, to make room for the pixmaps, because you basically have two copies of them. So there's that. The other thing is that a lot of people are, and thankfully, and everyone who's doing that, thank you very much, are running KD4 with debug symbols, which makes the application larger, slower to start up, etc. But it gives us, when problems do happen, it makes it easier to debug. So we can look at debug output on the console, we can get back traces from the debugger, etc. When people actually get KD4 on their desktop, they'll be running optimized builds, which will be, even faster, even smaller, and even lighter. So doing comparisons right now is often difficult between the two. And then again, this is a .0 release that we're about to release, 4.0, and I mean, we've spent so much time optimizing KD3. We'll be doing the same process over the years that come with KD4. So as good as it is right now, and I'm actually really happy with how it is right now, we'll get even better with over time with KD4. Now there's that number 40%, and that was actually one of those unfortunate misapplications of measuring. You will find certain applications. A lot of applications will be significantly smaller than the same application KD3 or a comparable application. But you can't just sum up 10 applications, using, some, add, usage A, B, C, D, E all the way, from 0 to 10 and add up that way, because there's memory that's shared, there's memory that's paged out, there's memory that's, memory that's managed in different ways by the kernel. So the actual memory usage is not a 40% summed difference. There was essentially a methodological error in that. It is smaller. It's not 40% smaller. But, the footprint is better. And I'm really happy that we've achieved that because, KD3 wasn't particularly bloated. You could run it. I have it running on a machine here that's, doesn't even have 100 megs of RAM. Obviously, it's not going to, run 50 applications at once, but it runs very well. KD3 was pretty good, especially when you compare it to what's coming out of Apple and Microsoft these days, where they both just use more and more and more RAM, and you wonder where it's going to, and the processor, improvements, you just don't see can't really see the benefits coming with it. So I'm pretty happy with what we've done with KD4, given that our measuring stick is KD3. I think if you put us up against, you know, the proprietary competition, it's pretty fantastic, actually, because we're keeping pace with them in features and capabilities. In some cases, we're actually pushing the envelope ahead of them, and we're coming in way under budget as far as performance goes.
If you were trying to entice somebody to check out KDE 4.0, someone who hadn't tried KDE in some time,
right,
what would you say would be the top drawing for it? What makes it appealing for people to try out?
What makes it appealing? And this depends on who it is, right? I mean, something that appeals to person A is not going to appeal to person B. But I mean, I think the big things that are really impactful are, you know, the visible usability improvements. You know, try Dolphin out as an example. Play with Dolphin for a few minutes. Don't just look at it, but actually play with it, because you'll start to notice little things like little animations that are very subtle, purposefully subtle, but which make things feel very smooth. If you pay really close attention, you'll notice things that used to be configuration options are now what I call implied configuration. So, you know, you don't right-click on the sidebar and say, I'd like small, medium, or large icons, please. You just, you know, change the size of the sidebar by, you know, click and dragging on it, and the icons, you know, resize smoothly, again, animated, as you do that. The breadcrumb bar, which also turns into a full-fledged, old-fashioned location bar, those kinds of little details are really compelling. And in Dolphin as well, you'll get a really good example of, you know, the new look and feel, the icons, the metadata indexing and whatnot. And it's one application that's really good to sit down and just kind of play with for a bit and go. And you can see so many of the different improvements, whether it's usability or look and feel or new framework functionality. Other than that, Conqueror, it's kind of interesting to see an application like Conqueror, which debuted in 2.0, still be around and functional and looking good and well, you know, in 4.0, which I think, again, says a lot about the robustness and the maturity of the frameworks that we carry forward from release to release. I don't want to go on too much about it, but, you know, Plasma, I think, is pretty cool. It does a lot of things that, I mean, we present it as a traditional desktop in 4.0, but it's not a, you know, it's a lot more than a traditional desktop under the hood, and it's simply masquerading as one, because people freak out if they don't get that. But the ability to, you know, do things like throw random widgets either on your panel or on your desktop, and then, you know, you mouse over them, you get this little handle, and you can resize them, rotate them, move them around, zoom in, zoom out, bring them on top of your windows with a, you know, you hit Control-F12 and you get a dashboard view of your desktop. Things like that, you know, we're starting to experiment with new ways of interacting with things that are pretty cool. And the visuals are just slick. So, yeah. Those are the things that if someone hasn't played around with KDE, I'd really recommend, starting especially with Dolphin. I think Dolphin really showcases a nice broad cross-section of advancements.
Let me talk to you about Dolphin a second. I'm looking at screenshots of Dolphin.
Yep.
And we received an interesting email a couple weeks ago that pointed out a trend that seems to be occurring in a lot of updated applications these days. And it's the lack of the ability to supply a path to the application. Like in Conqueror, where you could provide a path. Now, I see some screenshots. You have the capability of turning that on, a browser-type path.
Yep,
but
absolutely.
It seems like by default, it appears that it is not available. What is the compelling reason behind that? I'm noticing that more and more, that it seems people want you to browse using, you know, the icons and double clicking your mouse as opposed to supplying a path.
I have a friend who used to race cars semi-legally on the street many years ago before he was a father and whatnot. And, you'd sit down with him and start talking cars, and then inevitably he would start talking about, you know, manual shift transmissions and how they were in every possible way superior to anything they ever come out with automatic. He doesn't understand why people drive automatic cars.
I don't either.
I'm a good example. I can drive a stick shift, but I suck at it. I just obviously haven't practiced enough. For me, it's not comfortable. I don't really care about shifting. I just want the car to go. So when you take something like a vehicle, and it's a matter of audience and who you're approaching, right? So when you take something like a vehicle, and you go, I want it only to be driven by, you know, high-performance enthusiasts. I want it to be, you're either going to put in a really slick, you know, semi-automatic, you know, transmission, whatever, or you're going to put in a fully manual system, because those people probably demand it. When you want to, provide a car to, the billion people in China and, the hundreds of millions in North America and, the hundreds of millions in Europe and South America and whatnot, you don't really have that option, right? Because you've got this new audience that is never going to become as sophisticated with, driving a car that everyone can do a stick shift and not even think about it. If you give them a choice, if you force them to, they'll learn how to drive stick. But if you give them a choice between something that just goes when you press the gas pedal, they'll go, I want the thing that just goes. So a breadcrumb. Why a breadcrumb? Well, breadcrumbs are pretty cool because they actually are rather efficient. And I'm someone who loves, the good old-fashioned URLs and paths. I grew up with them. I understand them. They're, they work with my head. But they're actually really, breadcrumbs are really fast because the one we have in KDE4, for instance, you can click on. So you've got, like, say, your 10 level deep or whatever. And you go to the third or fourth or whatever directory or folder, click on it, and you'll get a drop-down of folders that are in there, and you can switch from that point, even though you're 10 levels deep, you can switch to a fourth level deep folder really, really fast and with very few keystrokes at all. So there are some very cool things. And we haven't limited it as well. I mean, we are, still the network transparent desktop, yada, yada. So when you're accessing something over FISH or SFTP or what have you, you actually do get that drop-down that shows you the available protocols right within the breadcrumb, right? We've tried not to dumb it down to the point where it's useless. But that's something that a lot of people understand better, in part because it has it, they're not visually looking for a separator symbol, right? What is a forward slash versus a backslash, and, what does that actually mean? How do I separate it? Visually, it's hard because everything's all crammed together, so you don't have to separate those things out. And we can also provide some abstractions so that, for instance, if you are viewing your home directory, we can actually just put home on the breadcrumb. We don't have to put, home and then what your username is, wherever your home happens to be on your system. If you've got a place that's bookmarked, we can actually show that place, if you navigate to it, we can actually show that bookmark as part of the breadcrumb. So these things start to make more human sense for most people. At the same time, we're not trying to make a clown car that's, only good for, being driven by idiots. We want something that's also comfortable for, the power users, people like, you and me and many of your listeners. So we have tried to, make defaults that work for as many people in our audience as possible. And we have an audience that numbers in the millions, right? So, for better or worse, we're becoming, an increasingly smaller group, but a very important group. So we're not discounting that. Number one, it has to work well for us as well. So the breadcrumb, there's a lot of work that's put into it to actually make it useful even from a power user's perspective, things like having the protocol drop-down. But you can easily switch to the full edit. You can either do it on a case-by-case basis. If you go to the far right of the breadcrumb and click, there's a little caret that shows, and you click, and it turns into the fully editable bar. If you want to go the configuration route, we actually, in Dolphin, there's a configuration option in the config dialog to let you switch back. So, it is these difficult questions of how do we keep software that is useful and has high utility to, the stick shift crowd, but also allows us to bring free software fully and comfortably to our existing user base that we're not, haven't been doing as good as we can, as well as appeal to an even wider audience. So it's a balancing act, and I think that with KDE4 we've done, if I may say so, I think we've actually done a better job of striking those balances in places than I think pretty much any other effort out there. I think most other efforts either dumb things down too much, simplify things too much, hide things too much, or too complex on the other, going the other direction. So I think we've hit a lot. I mean, we probably still have places we can improve on that balance as well, but I'm fairly happy with things like the breadcrumb. It's more approachable, but there's a way to get to the full edit. And of course in Conqueror, it's a full edit because Conqueror is a power tool and a web browser. So it makes no sense to have a breadcrumb there.
So you've, in a sense, with Dolphin, you've decoupled the web browser from the file manager. And Conqueror, you're going to leave it as the power tool. Are there going to be any changes to Conqueror, or is it still going to proceed along the path that it is to be the Swiss Army knife?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I eventually expect that we'll see a Dolphin-esque web browser, by the way, at some point in the future. That's just kind of, you can kind of see the way things flow, and that's probably an inevitability. But Conqueror will always remain, I mean, that's its point of existence, right? The whole design concept behind Conqueror is this, you know, the graphical shell, and it's a very powerful and very compelling tool. I love it. As do a large number of our users. There's absolutely no reason to get rid of it or suddenly shift its focus. In fact, that's one of the reasons we brought Dolphin in. How do you bring these two competing and you know, not, you can't have both Dolphin inside of Conqueror and Conqueror still be Conqueror. You have to ruin one or the other. So we opted to provide multiple solutions in this case. And Conqueror will continue to be the Swiss Army knife. It also continues to be improved. So, I mean, the toolbars and whatnot are nicer, you know, and the rendering engine is better and et cetera. These things, you know, Conqueror will continue to improve, well, has continued to improve. But no, it's not going to change focus and become a tool other than what it was designed for originally, which is that all-in-one browser. I think that's an interesting distinction to make as well, is that Conqueror is a browser, whether you talk web browsing or file browsing or browsing in general. The whole IO slaves and kparts concept, whereas Dolphin is a file manager. It's not designed to go around and browse your files, right? Conqueror, you go around your file system, whether it's local or remote, and you click on a file, and oftentimes it'll open up right in Conqueror because you're browsing it. Whereas Dolphin is a manager, and it simply is there to manage the contents of what you have on your disk. Again, whether that's local or remote is another matter.
So do you foresee, you know, you have the file manager, and then you have, you're talking about a future of a Dolphin browser. Do you see those two components phasing out Conqueror, or do you think Conqueror itself will continue to exist?
Well, if you look at, I think it's interesting to reflect upon what happened with K-Control. K-Control, there was a few people that really liked it because it had this, you know, really big tree view down the side. And when we replaced it with system settings, we just replaced it, in part because we just didn't have anybody that was kicking around that was interested in maintaining K-Control. If anybody had stepped up and went, hey, I'm interested in maintaining K-Control, we'd have been like, great, let's move K-Control to Extra Gear and continue to maintain it, right? This is free software. You can do what you want to do. No one's going to say no. But what was interesting with that change was there wasn't enough interest from anyone to actually continue working on K-Control. A lot of the people that were, you know, our hardcore users, I mean, as developers, we're probably the most hardcore of users. A lot of ushers like, oh my god, we hate that application. It has so many problems, you know, and not the system settings is perfect yet, but it's a much better place to start from, much better substrate. And a lot of the people that were like, oh, I can't stand system settings, you know, I love K-Control, some of those people fixed system settings to, you know, the problems, they, you know, the things they didn't like in it, and other people eventually came around and said, okay, I've been using it for a couple weeks, and I have to admit, yeah, I'm actually faster with it. You know, contrast that with Conqueror. There's, of the people that use Conqueror, there are very few, other than those who feel they have no other option than to use Conqueror, but most of us are like, yeah, Conqueror's awesome. We love it. The most hardcore of users, the developers, whatnot, a lot of us love Conqueror. I do. A lot of our user base loves Conqueror. And that's the important thing, right? We've got developers and our core user base that really loves this application. And unlike K-Control and system settings, which are really just duplications of the same thing, Conqueror is a very different tool than Dolphin. It's a browser versus a manager. It's an all-in-one tool versus a specific, you know, application. The audience is slightly different. So I don't think that unless there's significant change in our core group of, you know, hardcore users and software developers, that Conqueror is going to go anywhere. We've committed to Conqueror straight through the KD4 series. I've committed patches to it. David Farr has done a ton of work to it, as have others. You know, the HTML people continue to work on that. So, I mean, there's no sign of interest flagging. And that's what a free software project lives and dies by, is the attention paid to it.
I got a question on a different vein here. Over the past couple of years, we've seen a shift in a lot of the commercial wannabe distributions pushing towards the use of GNOME, SUSE, Ubuntu, I believe Fedora, all kind of seem to circulate around GNOME. And we've heard a lot in the past that KDE seems to be the favorite desktop overall. Of course, we could debate that right and left. A lot of people have proffered that KDE is the desktop or window desktop environment of choice for people migrating from Windows to Linux because it is close to what they are familiar or comfortable with using. Now, we're starting to see another trend here that's coming along with the Triple E PC with the release of the GOS operating system and the GPC and a few other devices and Linux commercial Linux offerings that we're not getting a GNOME or a KDE desktop. We're getting a customized shell around something or completely different desktop that almost flies in the face of what, you know, people seem to be used to. What are your opinions on that? Because I've been playing around with the GOS and the GPC, and the interface to that is very alien compared to what the target audience, I think, is for those users.
Yeah, I think that the industry in general is doing a lot of, seeking out as to how these things work. My personal favorite of these new, and you may not have thought about it in this way, but my favorite in this new realm is actually the Nintendo Wii. They have a lot of usability problems yet to work out with their user interface, but I really like what they've done with it. And really, they've put like a user interface on top of their box, and it's one of the nicest ones as far as aesthetics and simplicity, and it's not quite consistent in some places, but they do pretty good there as well. But I think in general, the industry, especially the consumer electronics industry, is really hunting and seeking around for these things. This was a trend that a lot of us saw coming years ago. It's kind of one of those, by the time it hits the consumer market, it's been happening for a long time in industry, right? We've been talking and thinking about it. So one of the use cases that we looked at when we were designing Plasma, for instance, and KD4, is how do you repurpose an interface to other devices? I do think it's kind of unfortunate that so much time gets wasted writing custom shells. It should be very, very easy, trivial, in fact, to repurpose an interface. You should have to rewrite as little as possible. You always have to tweak something. You always will want to have some little bit that's, interesting or new or different or whatnot. But that should be, A, easy to do, quick to do, not compromise the stability of the system because it'll be the least tested, right? Because it'll be your little custom bit on top of the commodity bits. So it needs to be able to be done quickly, efficiently, with stability. But you should also be able to tap into the work of the commodity stack and use as much of that as possible. I think we're going to see a lot more work towards that. I'm a little disappointed to date with how all these devices do their own from scratch kind of thing, and they share extremely little. At best, they might share toolkit, and that's about it. And I think there's a lot more opportunity here for sharing code and technology. On the other hand, I'm not disappointed because it's given us the opportunity to bring Plasma out and start using it or start playing with it in some of these venues and showing what can be possible. So our options there. But as far as the general trend, I think it's great because, to date we've been toe-to-toe with, Microsoft and Apple and, kind of fighting over this user base. And they are, especially Microsoft, they're the entrenched, player, two bones about it. Microsoft has a monopoly on the desktop. So it's a very difficult place to make inroads to. So with the advent of things like, the Triple E PC or the GPC or GOS or whatnot, that's really what they call it blue ocean markets, right? Instead of trying to crowd your ships into the same old ports that everyone else has got their, ships coming in and out of, strike for the open ocean. And start looking for new lands. Look for new markets. Create new markets. Invent new markets. Asus was doing exactly that, right? I mean, they were looking for a way. You read their interviews in financial magazines and business magazines, and they say quite plainly, we wanted to start moving up the stack, but we didn't want to have to compete with, the Dells and the Lenovos of the world. We want, we figured that if we're going to do this, we need to create some new segment of the market, and they've done that. And free software is the perfect fit for them when they're doing this. So it's really cool because we're, you know, in these new markets, like the AAA PC is a great example, or the Classmate PC for that matter, both of those, you know, really great successes for KDE on these small form factor devices. And Microsoft is scrabbling to play catch up, and they're doing everything they can to dislodge us from these devices, which good, you know, it keeps us honest and keeps us, you know, on our toes and whatnot. But it's so cool to be on the other side of that for once, and to actually be, you know, the guy, you know, that is, you know, is on the side of, we're the one who's already here, and you're the second comer. You know, it's an interesting dynamic, and I think it's going to open up a huge amount of possibility, because with devices like that, right now, when free software controls the game, open standards are just no-brainers. They become much, much more easy to get in there. We have the ability to interact with them and interoperate with them with our other devices, including traditional devices like desktops and laptops, much more easily because, well, you know what, we were involved in writing that code as well on these devices. So the interoperability becomes a lot easier. It opens up the market in every single way. So I'm really excited about these you know, two market devices that are having, you know, important impacts. I just, every time I look at that, you know, very realistic sales projection of 3 to 5 million units by summer for just that one device, God, that opens up so many doors for free software. It's difficult to overstate it.
Imagine if they dropped the price a little bit, they'd probably sell four times the amount what they're doing now.
Well, and I think they will eventually. I mean, they've got another model that's coming out that is a lower price and aimed at developing nations. But, you know, it's interesting because, I mean, you know, $400, you get a, you know, complete laptop, whatever, it's pretty good. I got one for my son for Christmas. He went into a store to get a new bag for it, like a proper little laptop bag. And it was funny because he opened it up. He's 7 years old, right? He opens it up, connects to Wi-Fi in the store, gets on the Internet, and people start crowding around and looking at this device and saying how cool it is and, wow, you know, and, wow, where'd you get that? And, you know, yeah, it was in a Best Buy, and they didn't have them, right? And so everyone's, like, looking around it. And it's one of those things, like, you can't, you know, buy that kind of advertising. It's this shoe on the other foot where we're so used to trying to have to prove ourselves, and, you know, now we're on a device that people crowd around in a store and go, ooh, that's really cool, which is very rewarding.
We had a question a little while back in our IRC regarding portability of KDE.
Yep.
And how important is portability, particularly to I think you had mentioned that it's important with OS X and Windows, but what about the BSDs?
Right. So we've done, the BSD community is actually self-sufficient. All of our communities are self-sufficient. I mean, that's, again, how kind of free software works. We don't have a top-down budget, and we say, well, we've got, you know, $1 million, and we're going to allocate $10 million to here and $10 million to there and, you know, whatever. All of our communities need to be self-supportive, really. So what's nice about the BSD community is that they really embrace KDE. I mean, KDE is the overwhelmingly dominant desktop on their side. I'm in part, and well, I'm not sure which way it flew, you know, chicken and egg kind of problem here. We've got a lot of people in the KDE project that work on, you know, as core developers and whatnot, that actually, you know, do run BSD and as their first choice of operating system. That helps when you've got, you know, developers that are using it on a daily basis. And the other side of it is you've got products like PCBSD, right, which is, you know, probably the most user-friendly version of BSD, and some of the BSD hardcore, you know, the old school users would be like, oh, that's, I don't really like some of the decisions they made. But, you know, they're having good success with it, including getting, you know, some deployments. I think they had some stuff out in Fry's recently. You know, they're using KDE stuff, and so that helps as well because that creates the community around it that helps make sure that we're portable. Obviously, people commit code from time to time that doesn't build or doesn't work on a given system or whatnot, and, you know, but it gets caught by this community, and we're very much about bringing those patches upstream as much as possible, limiting the amount of effort to, you know, host on these platforms. But also has another effect, and that is it makes it very easy to port our code to new platforms. It makes our code more robust. It removes assumptions in our code that both future-proof it as well as improve the quality. So it's like everyone wins. With Solaris, as another example, you know, Sun has recently given us, you know, some hardware, some servers, well, some desktop workstation style software, hardware, as well as some servers. And we actually are building KDE4 and whatnot on there, and there's a really healthy and growing KDE Solaris community that is working on ensuring that KDE4 works, you know, really well on Open Solaris. And so it's, again, another one of these self-supporting communities. And it benefits everybody. If the BSD people were just to pack up and go away, I'm sure that within short order, you know, within a year or so, KDE wouldn't build or work very well on those operating systems. But, and that's really why we spend a lot of time on community development and trying to ensure that our community is, you know, friendly, affording to, you know, others, that we don't have an elitist, you know, it's Linux-centric or whatnot. Even the people that work for the Linux distributions are very open-minded in the same way. So I'm actually, it's one of the, I think, the strengths of the project.
It's good stuff. It's really exciting. I'm really looking forward to seeing KDE 4.0. I guess the question that comes up is, how long till KDE 4.1?
That is a good question. We don't have a firm date set, so I'm going to prognosticate slightly here, and just kind of put a general feeler out there. I don't think that a 6 month, you know, cycle, 6-ish month cycle for 4.1 would be unusual or uncalled for. There have actually been people asking for an even shorter development cycle than that, which is a little bit ludicrous. But there's a few reasons for that. Number one, Qt 4.4, which we'll be using in KDE 4.1, is being released imminently. So we want to start taking advantage of a lot of the things in Qt 4.4 as soon as possible. We get, you know, a number of performance benefits as well as benefits when it comes to things like WebKit and widgets on Canvas, and which, you know, Plasma really benefits from, and a host of bug fixes and improvements and things like XML handling. So we really want to move to that. Then there's also the issue that there's a ton of stuff in 4.0 that's like 90% done. For instance, the Windows and Mac native ports are at basically technology preview point. They work. You can run applications. There's still rough edges. There's things that could still be better. And so we're kind of looking at those things as being, you know, when 4.0 comes out, they're going to be like, you know, 80, 90% done. They don't need another, you know, 9-month cycle to actually get to where they need to be. And we do want to, you know, start moving that, development, you know, wheel a bit faster now that we're, you know, out of the blue sky development and down to, you know, batten down the hatches. Let's move to a highly mature platform again. So, you know, I think it's reasonable to expect that, you know, we'll see the release schedule be announced to be sometime in the summer. And this time, what's interesting is that as opposed to a floating schedule, which we afforded ourselves for the first time, I think, 7 years, 7 years ago was the last time we finished a floating schedule for 2.0, you know, we're going back to our set release cycles where we say it's going to be released on, you know, such a week, and we actually work towards that and hit that. So back to time-based versus feature-based.
Good stuff. I'm really looking forward to it, and I just want to thank you, Aaron. You and all the KDE developers are doing fantastic work. You guys, you know, keep it up. You know, I'm sure you guys get plenty of negative mail, but I'd like to just chime in with some positives. You guys are doing fantastic.
Great.
I love KDE. Like, I started with Linux in like around 98 or so.
Yeah.
You know, I tried GNOME for a bit, and then I switched to KDE, and I really haven't switched. I mean, I still use the other desktops and window managers to a certain degree, but KDE is the vast majority of my time in a Linux desktop is in KDE.
That's very cool. And, you know, if you come across something that you really like, drop, you know, that team, and it's not just developers, but artists and documenters and translators and whatnot, drop the team a quick email. If you don't know how to get a hold of them, you can drop me an email. I'll send you in the right direction. But it's really cool when, you know, a developer from an app goes, you know, gets a little, you know, wow, I did this thing that I didn't know you could do, or I really appreciated that, you know, little feature, the way you did that, that's really cool. You know, positives are really cool, and so it's really appreciated. And if you do stumble across something that you go, man, I don't really quite understand that, you know, one of the things I've been trying to encourage people to do is find a way to phrase it in a constructive manner. I think that our community spends a lot, way too much time kind of showing off how good we are at being pricks to each other, you know, to put it bluntly. And we don't often afford each other the realization that we're all into this together and that we're actually part of a broader community working on things together. And, you know, it's fine to be critical, but find a way to be constructively critical about it, if I can challenge the people listening to this. Next time you have a bug report or whatnot, try and, you know, spend your time researching, you know, as much as you can the causes of it. Be positive. Try to stay away from, you know, invectives and pejoratives and whatnot, and just be factual about it. And you'll find that developers are a lot more open, a lot, you know, receive it a lot better, and you'll probably get your bug fixed faster.
Now, see, I always like submitted my bug reports by starting off this piece of garbage that you idiotic developers hacked together just doesn't work. What's wrong with you? You mean that's not the way to do it?
No, and Will, that's a really funny joke. I get bug reports like that come through bugs.kd.org, because I get CC'd on a lot of them. That's pretty much the bug report in a nutshell, and then just provide some specifics for a given application or library or whatnot. So sadly, that is apparently how a lot of people in our community, who are otherwise really great people, like I've met some of these people in person afterwards, and it's like, dude, what happens when you get in front of a computer, man? You're a lot nicer in person. But yeah, I mean, it's that. It's what a lot of communication happens, and I think people lose track of the idea that there's people on the other side of this.
That's a shame. You know what?
Yeah, but then we get people like you who are like, you know, hey, you guys are doing cool things, and yeah, if you can get out to an event like the conferences and whatnot, even if it's a hardcore, you know, developer conference or whatnot, you stop by for like half an hour. Meeting the people is such a cool thing. It's a real eye opener to how everything works.
I also wanted to echo Pat in thanking you and the developers of KDE, primarily on behalf of my wife and kids who absolutely love using KDE.
Thank you. That's very nice.
They have no problems using it. It's been great for them. They love it. So thank you.
Here.
Well, great, and hopefully we can continue to take it even further for you guys.
Don't mess it up. All right.
Try not to. And you said you had kids, so you're going to get them into programming, and then they'll become the next. We've got to find these new developers somewhere.
Well, you know, the older ones had messed around with Logo, and we'll get her back into some other stuff soon. But,
K-Turtle in
K-Turtle. That's what she was using.
Yeah. The one in KD4 is, like, so much more cool than the one in KD3, by the way. The edgy stuff is, and the games, those two things in KD4 are just insanely great already in 4.0. I can't even imagine what they're going to do in 4.1 to top what they've done in 4.0. But yeah, K-Turtle, for instance, is just fantastic. Like in 3, if you couldn't make the window any bigger or smaller, in KD4 it's completely scalable. And it supports like a much more newer version of the local language, and it's more performant. And it's really cool looking. And it still has a little turtle, which is so cool. I love that. Those of you who haven't used K-Turtle and they're listening right now, you're probably going, what is he talking about?
Yeah, K-Turtle's awesome. The whole education suite of applications is really nice. Mm-hmm. What is it? Is it K-Educa? Is that it? The one that does...
Yep, that's one of them.
That's a great application.
You know, and it was funny because K-Educa almost didn't get ported. And then someone wrote about that in their blog, mentioned, you know, we got almost everything ported, but this one's not going to get ported, probably won't be there in 4.0. And a teacher somewhere, I forget where they're from in the world, came back and were like, you can't, because I actually use that. I actually need that program. And it actually inspired someone to step up and port it, so it's there in KD4 as well. So that's a great example as well of how, you know, positive feedback really does have an impactful, you know, or can have, anyways, an impactful result. Because it was just that one little bit of feedback of someone going, are you kidding me? I love that application. I use it. I actually use it as a teacher. So please, you know, port it for me. and they did. So it was really cool.
That's some good stuff. You've done a great job.
Yeah, well, we've had the help of thousands. So, you know, it's the old standing on the shoulders of giants, right? And that's not just the KDE project, but everybody in the free software world going back, you know, as far back as the original, you know, hackers in the MIT labs back in the 60s. So it's a very large, I don't know, pedigree to kind of live up to. And I think, you know, being involved in a project like KDE, it's amazing. There are very few things that you can compare it to in life. So anyone who's listening is kind of, you know, pondering whether to get involved and wondering if it's worth your time. You know William Gibson, the writer? Not to take too much more time, but I was at a reading of his, and someone asked him how he found the time to become an author. And he said, I just stopped watching TV. He says, because I found that if I wrote instead of watching TV, I suddenly had the time to write as many novels as I wanted. And I thought that was kind of funny, because it's very true. We find time for the things we love, right? And if you're a technologist, I've done a few different things in my life in technology, and none of them have even compared close as far as reward goes when it comes to being involved with free software.
Now, see, I echo William Gibson there in saying, now that, you know, the less time I spend watching TV, the more time I have playing video games, which is very interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting how that works.
Yes. But that's
but anyways, great. Well, thanks for having me on, guys.
Hey, thank you.
It's been great.
Anytime.
Yeah, definitely. And, watch out for our release event. We'll be posting the videos of all the talks and everything online so people can watch it and follow it as it happens. And it's going to be pretty fun.
I wish I could make that.
Oh, well, the next one.
Yep. We'll meet up eventually.
Exactly. And then we'll be like, oh, it's you. Names to faces.
Exactly.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
You guys have a good night.
You too. Happy New Year.
Take care, Aaron. Happy New Year.
Take it easy.
Likewise. Happy New Year. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Awesome interview with Aaron.
Ta-da!
Yes, it was very good.
Alan, thanks for the questions.
Alan. Yeah, Alan, you were very insightful there.
I try to be.
You were on fire tonight.
I was posting them on the other channel for you, so whenever I saw one come by.
That was very helpful. If I would have looked over there instead of scrolling backwards to my IRSSI session trying to find that 16-paragraph question that trolls asked.
Yeah, that was quite a large one there.
So, Dan, I saw your fourth IRC ID pop up. Dan Gios?
Yes.
Did you finally plug the thing in and try it?
Yeah, I had my daughter set it up. It was funny. I had her set it
up. Did you videotape it?
No, I didn't videotape it. I took some pictures, but I had her set it up. And I didn't like where it was, so I made her take it apart and set it up again somewhere else. So she was a bit miffed at that, but she got it together fast. I gave her the PC, and then I gave her the instructions and said get to work, and made her do it all herself. So I have a recording of her. I don't have a video camera anymore. The one I had was a school's.
Yeah. Oh, I thought the dog ate it.
No. I wish. The only thing I have is this crappy Walmart camera that we paid $50 for. You saw it, the pink one.
The pink one, yeah.
Yeah, it takes crappy pictures, man. That thing's...
The one with the Hello Kitty on the side of it?
Yeah, no, I wish it had a Hello Kitty on the side of it. It'd probably take better pictures. But you get two modes. You get dark and washed out.
Speaking of cameras, I ordered a new digital camera. I got a new Canon. And I ordered it from Newegg, and I'm waiting to get it. And I also got a couple of data cards to go with it. And I get this package in the mail today, and it says Newegg. I open it up, and the invoice says one of the data cards, but it's not one of my data cards. It's a TrendNet USB 2.0, the serial ATA IDE converter adapter. I call them up, you know, the Newegg customer support, and I tell them, you know, this is not what I ordered, even though the invoice is correct, you know. Maybe the people packing the package were having a little New Year celebration or something when they did it. I mean, I looked at the numbers on the package, and none of them were even close to what was on the invoice. So I don't know what the hell happened. Anyway, they said, you know what, we'll send you everything. It's on the way. Don't worry about it. Keep what we sent you. It's on us. So I'm like, yeah, what the hell does this go for? I don't know, $10-$15. Usually Newegg, if something's like $20 or less, and they break it, you know, or, you know, they accidentally send it to you, they'll say, you know, keep it. So I looked it up. This thing goes for like $50, man.
That's cool.
So thank you, Newegg, for the free complimentary converter plug.
Now you just have to get something to plug into it.
Well, I think what it is you could take an internal like hard drive or DVD drive and hook it up to this thing and use it with like a laptop or something.
Okay.
And it's got the USB connection on the side and so.
Yeah, I like Newegg. Newegg
is great. I've had for the most part, I've had good experiences with them.
I've never ordered anything from them.
I've got a ton of stuff over the years from them.
What the hell's wrong with you, Alan?
Well, because I like to go to stores and get something. Because usually when I want something, I want it right now.
I don't want
to wait for shipping. I'm very much an impulse buyer, as you can tell by the amount of crap I usually have. But I actually want the damn thing right now, and, you know, I don't want to wait for shipping.
So that explains the Apple Store fetish that Alan has.
Yeah, I was going to say, and the store he prefers happens to be the Apple Store.
It explains a lot of my buying habits, let's put it that way. We'll get to see whether the silence killer works.
I am posting a link in the IRC for this web blog that I found. It's emmaalvarez.com. That's emmaalvarez.com.
Is that work safe, Dan?
No, it's completely work safe. I found it because there was a posting today on LX or about top 10 applications, and she had done two postings of the top 50 open source or Linux applications, a lot of them dealing with graphics and video, and her site is just like a geek's paradise. Mythology, fantasy, and computers and stuff. It's really interesting.
Goofy,
check her out.
Goofy pet pictures?
No, I don't. No, she's an artist. I know that. I don't see goofy pet pictures on here.
I'm scrolling down. I see a whole bunch of them.
Where?
Top 2007 funny animal photos.
Oh, okay. Well, there we go.
They got a pug dressed as Darth Vader.
But it's just, I just saw, she's got a nice little posting of Conan in the comic, in the movies, and now in video games. Because anybody who talks about Conan's got to be good.
Of course.
Dun, dun, dun. Talk amongst yourselves, I got to go grab my laptop to play the song tonight. I'll be right back.
Sure. I was checking out this new IceCast client. Normally we've been using, I know Dan uses it most of the time, and I've used it when I did the show from my place. We use Dynabolic, which is a live audio-based CD, and the IceCast client that's on there is called Muse. It works great, but it's a live CD environment, and I want to find something that I could run just on my workstation, so I don't have to reboot into, you know, a CD environment. So, we got an email a few days ago about this new IceCast client called BUT. Stands for Broadcast Using This Tool. And it's over at SourceForge. I'll put the link in the IRC. And I tried this out today. And it's a pretty nice interface, pretty simple. It'll let you record your stream to a file. You can do streams either in OGG or MP3. Curiously, when I was doing the testing before the show, I was playing it, and it sounded like the stream was going over. It sounded like the audio, we were all talking like a half an octave lower than our normal voices. It was pretty weird. It was a really bizarre thing, and I thought it was maybe the bit rate that the audio was streaming out at, so I was playing around with the bit rate, increasing it, decreasing it, changing it from mono to stereo, and nothing affected it. So it has a setting for your sound card, so there was like the full PCM, Dev DSP, it also had my chipset. My workstation has an NVIDIA chipset, so it was in there. So I started trying the different audio devices, and strangely, depending on which one I selected, it affected the sound of it. So finally, I went with just the one that was called Default, and that seemed to do the trick. So more than likely I'm going to be using this the next time I you know, I stream the show from my place the next time it happens.
Was that butt?
So, yeah, but it was pretty weird, though. Like I said, depending on what audio device was selected in the preferences, it changed the sound of it. It was pretty weird. But I got it working, and it looks decent. So I don't have to go, you know, bring into Dynabolic to get the IceCast client working. I can use this. So it's written by Daniel Nofen. He works with Shoutcast, IceCast. Yeah, one of the things I didn't realize is you can't listen to a stream from the machine that you're streaming from. And you can't listen to the site that you're streaming to. So what I did wound up doing was I wound up pointing my audio player to one of the mirrors that we have, and I was able to listen to it that way. I didn't know that.
Hmm. Yeah, I ran into that problem the first time I tried streaming. I'm like, well, what's going on here? Because I thought you could stream and listen to it on the same machine, but no. It don't work like that. I mean, you might be able to do it if you had two separate sound cards.
I don't know. I was having the same problem from another machine. I think it happens to be the IP address you're streaming from. I tried it on two different machines. I tried it on my laptop. I also tried it on my audio recorder here, my Studio 64 setup, and neither one of them could stream from it. So it was only until I pointed to the mirror that it actually worked. So I'll be using that next time.
All righty.
So what's our song for this evening?
That's what?
I was just going to say, what's our song, but I didn't realize Pat wasn't done yet. Sorry.
I was just going to say, it was just weird, like, hearing it. It was like, we were all talking with, like, really deep voices like this. And it was, like, half an octave down. It was just the kookiest thing.
Hopefully next week, our guest is Varel Hakan, right?
Varel Hakan, yeah.
We haven't talked to him in a while.
It's been a while since we talked to him, yeah.
Yeah, hopefully Link will be back next week and not have to work.
That would be nice.
I miss Link.
He'll be back. Don't worry,
Dan. He hates us. Well, he's gonna. You know what's gonna happen? Here's the prediction for 2008. Link is going to drop out of the show and start his own show called the Link Apple Podcast, based upon his newfound love for the Apple technology.
And he's gonna go. He's gonna go by the moniker of Stephen Fezzadin.
Yes.
Or Link Jobs.
Yes. We don't know
Stephen
which one.
J. Fennison.
Stephen J. Fennison. Yeah.
And Alan's going to be the sidekick. He's going to be Alan the Woz Metzer.
Alan Wozniak.
Oh, do I get a segue to go with that?
Or Steve Metzler. It'll be Steve Fennison and Steve Metzler. But you'll never know because Steve Metzler never talk. And you know what would be interesting?
If we do keynotes.
All the hate mail that we used to get for this show will just go right to his show instead.
We'll have a forwarding set up in place.
That's it. No, but hopefully Link will be back next week. I can understand, man. He must have, you know, the first of the year, that changeover on systems is always such a pain in the butt. Although I never usually have problems on my systems at home, but back where I used to work, it was always a scary thing. I don't know why. So what are we listening to tonight, Pat? Any other comments? Have we ever checked the Frapper map anymore?
We were around 2000 the last time I checked. We were coming up on it.
You know, we never actually went back and looked at Facebook and see whether... We were at.
He didn't do shit, that guy. I posted a comment and nothing happened.
Oh, okay.
We're the Rodney Dangerfield of Linux shows. We don't get any respect.
That's okay. Neither does a lot of Linux links. Linux Reality wasn't even on that list, was it?
No.
So.
No love. That's okay. That's
all
fine.
Right. It's all right.
We soldier on.
That's it. All right.
That's it.
Who are we listening to tonight?
We're gonna hear a song called Thirst from the band Atomic Opera. You can go listen to their music at magnitude.com. It's pretty good rocking stuff, man. Nice harmonies. It's really good. They're from Houston, Texas.
Oh, I know one last thing I wanted to bring up. I had to go fetch my laptop because the wife spilled a little bit of soup on her keyboard, and it totally wrecked the whole thing. The keyboard doesn't work, the trackpad doesn't work, and when you plug in an external keyboard, it types in funky characters, things are all messed up. So, unfortunately, we are down one laptop. Fortunately, unfortunately, my wife had to work over the holiday. Fortunately, she made triple time, so she's going to take that extra money and buy herself a new laptop. I think she's decided on a ruby red Dell.
You know, speaking of Dells, man, I went to the computer show this past weekend, and a guy had all the different Dells set up. It was the first time I actually seen some of those laptops. They had the 1420, they had the XPS 13, and the 15. That XPS laptop, that 1330, I think it's called, that's a sweet laptop, man. And I hear that they're going to be offering those with Ubuntu pretty soon.
What's the starting price on those? Going around. It's like
they're a little more money than the 1420s. They're the starting point, I think, is closer to a grand on those.
Yeah, we're going to go with the 1420.
I mean, that's a nice laptop, don't get me wrong. That's pretty sweet. And there's plenty of coupon codes floating around, you know, 200 off, 300 off. So.
Really? I got to look for one of those. If anyone knows.
Yes, I know where they are. Notebookreview.com. They have a button on the top of the toolbar with laptop deals. There's all different coupon codes in there.
And that works for the Linux-based ones, right? Ubuntu ones?
Of course. It works for all of them. I'll post the link in the IRC.
All right. That's cool. Thank you. So I guess we'll be back next week with more excitement and Raoul Okan. So.
Okan.
Okan. Butcher his name next week, too. So, all right.
Hey, thanks for listening, everybody.
See you next week. Happy New Year, everybody. Wish you all the best in 2008.
Already right. Food. Day.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up. It's over.